You tuned in to Relationship Factor, where we talk about all things relationships for millennials, moving you from a problem to solution, from functional to exceptional relationships. I'm your host, Kingsley Moyo. Hey, thanks again for downloading another episode of Relationship Factor. If we are not already connected, I hang out a lot on Instagram. Find me, the handle is Relationship Factor. Occasionally, they are dropping some relationship nuggets that'll pick you up and carry you throughout the week, and some helpful tips on how to build healthy relationships. And my guest today is Paul King Brown. Paul is a pastor and a divorce coach, the founder and owner of Picking Up the Pieces, a practice that is infused with his pastoral counseling and training and personal experience with divorce. We had a good conversation with Paul talking about how to heal from brokenness, your journey of healing, really, how you move from broken to breakthrough. Or we talk about how you deal with the hurt, the brokenness, and the relationship trauma. We outline some steps on how you can actually move from that painful space to a place where you can actually be a part of healthy and better relationships and show up in relationships in healthy ways. Join me for this conversation. The journey of healing.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that the phrase says journey of healing. So I'm guessing there must be a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, however many steps there is to the journey of healing. Paul, what are we talking about when we're talking about the journey of healing from broken to breakthrough? What are we talking about here? What kind of relationship are we looking at? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a multifaceted but a very great opening question. What is the journey of healing? I think one of the things that is paramount in the journey of healing is almost something we have to get rid of from children, is that the journey of healing doesn't go from 0 to 10 or just linear. The journey of healing can go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, crash.
Oh my.
Let's start again. The journey of healing also is incredibly individual, and I'm sure as I speak to your audience, as soon as you say something for one, the other 100, 200, 300 say, no, that's not me, because the journey of healing is very individual. And so the journey of healing my journey of healing is very unique to me. But what there is on the journey of healing is principles or nuggets along the way that you can pick up and you learn. And it's also, and the journey of healing works, I think, very much all the time. There is this.
All the time.
Yes. Yes.
It's interesting you mentioned that the journey of healing is individual. It's not linear. And more often, our thought process tends to be linear. I start from A to B to C to D. Mm-hmm. And so because I'm thinking that way, I'm looking around on social media, looking at other friends and saying, okay, how did they get their healing? And I assume that they went from A to B. So then I want to copy what they did. And then when I don't heal, I feel like I'm a failure. It's because I'm copying their healing, and healing can't be copied.
Mm. You see, healing can be in a sense copied, but healing is an experience, and healing is very much an experience. So you can read about other people's experiences and other people's healing, and you can extrapolate and take principles from this and then go, okay, I'm going to use this as a principle for my healing, only to find out they use the same steps and you can have a different reaction, a different story, come to a different place, and then you could write your own book on healing, and then someone else could take those things, and it could mean totally different things. And what
right.
Step number two was the step that was critical to my healing, but to you it could be step number four, because we all have a filter, and we filter life through information through our own individual experience from there. So I think that I've come in the last few years to the notion of healing is, and also let me go this way. I was talking to my daughter today. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about, my daughter's just had a baby, 1st of April, I became a grandfather for the first time. Phenomenal experience, whatever. And so I recognize more and more with my daughter, and now she has a baby, that the community, the village is important. There's all mm-hmm. these people, the grandparents, the uncles, whatever. Now, she comes from a divorced experience. So there's some members of the family that she hasn't seen for a long time. And what I was trying to say to her was, we're with you. We're with you. I know you're going through this experience. Mm-hmm. It's individual, but you know we are here. We're here supporting you. We're here with you. Go through your experience, but know that we're here with you, that when you fall, there are these people that are going to hold you up and uplift you and go from there. When I came to writing a book called Picking Up the Pieces and Divorce, was the reason I did this was because there was no support structure. I was alone and lost in this journey of healing because I had no idea how to deal with pain whatsoever.
And I think that's a crucial piece, the pain piece, knowing how to deal with pain. I don't think nobody sits down and teaches us how to deal with pain.
No, it's who would want to? You know, pain is excruciating. You know, one minute I am there in my house, in my big house with my big wife, and it's not, she wasn't fat, but I like saying this. My big house with my big wife and my big car and my big fist and my big ideas and my big whatever. And the next minute I find out my wife has an affair. And the pain is excruciating. And Psychology 101 says that all you want to do is, we want pleasure, and the other thing, we want to get rid of pain. So all I want her to say is, I'm sorry, I will never do this again. And so please don't leave me. I'm pathetic because the pain is excruciating. I just want the pain to go away. But she doesn't say this. And so the pain lingers. The pain goes on and on and on. So who in their right mind would turn around to you and say, actually, part of the first thing of the healing process I discovered was confronting that pain. Was actually
confronting the pain, or confronting the person.
Confronting the no.
You, so you got to work with the pain. It's an internal thing.
You do have to confront the person because you want to get rid of the pain and you want to survive this ordeal. I'm a divorcee. I've just got remarried, say 5 years, whatever. But divorce is my enemy. Okay, divorce is my enemy because I've seen the things hit wrecks. I've seen how you can go through the trauma of healing, and then someone invites you to a wedding or a funeral, and all the triggers and all this stuff around you goes through. You're healed. You're okay, but then you're placed back in a vulnerable situation. I realized the other day that actually. I realized that it's not that I don't like or I'm unfriendly to my ex-wife. It's that I just don't like who I am when I'm around this person anymore. Mm. This person who she was, whoever that person is, has moved on. So, but it sometimes it seems as though, do you ever go home? I used to go home, and every time you go home, I'm the eldest child, but you become the child. I used to go home.
You never stop being a child.
No, but I used to go home, and then I used to leave up after about an hour. I used to go there with my wife, go there with my daughter, and I go, okay, we've got to go now. My mum said, well, I've just cooked you loads of food. And I'm like, no, I've got to go now. And then one day my daughter said to me, why do you keep leaving? So we drive 50 miles, we go and see your mother, and then you leave. About an hour and a half. She goes, why didn't you ever want to stay? And I go, this just sounds really selfish. But when I go to my mother's house, I feel like I'm 10. I'm like, I don't want to feel like I'm Zen.
You're not in control anymore.
I'm not in control anymore. And so I feel like this. I feel like this now. So I'm with this. When I'm near the person who caused this pain, who's saying, "Oh, can't we be friends?" I'm like, I don't want to be that person in pain anymore. I don't want to be there anymore. I want to be this other person, that I like, that my wife loves, that feels empowered, the other person that's inspiring other people. I don't want to go back to the blocks, because sometimes it's in the language. It's in the language that we use. I remember, I don't want to be political, I won't mention who it was, but I was listening to this interview, and the interview was talking about the statistics of the person. And the statistics were incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And then the person said, the interviewer said, "Is that true?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah, it's true." And then he said, "Yeah, but the language, the rhetoric, the language." And so I think that healing has a language. I think healing has a language. Healing has a rhetoric, and that's born out of generosity first to yourself. So the conflict. So the number one thing I'm talking about is to actually go to the pain, and then because you're left alone a lot in this situation, you are left alone a lot. You have no.
Yeah, that's true. I see it. A divorce, or you've broken up with somebody, or somebody just cheated on you. You're all alone, and because you're all alone, if you don't confront that loneliness, that hurt, that pain, it's gonna follow you. So confront the pain.
Yeah, but let me say something very funny. So I was speaking to another divorce man. This was years ago, and he said, "You know what I've discovered?" Well, we were having this conversation. "You know what you discovered?" I said, "What?" He said, "I discovered that I'm a better husband now I'm divorced." And I went, "Yeah, what do you mean? He said, "I don't know whether you do this." And as he was talking, I was like, wow, the things, sparks were going off in my brain when he said it. He said, "So what you do, you're on your own and you start thinking about your life. You start thinking about this marriage, this relationship that went. And you start doing this reflecting, similar to when you have a conversation with someone and then they say something smart, but you don't say something as smart. And then you wish later on you're thinking, I knew the answer to that. I had a smart answer that I could have wiped you out with. But now you're sitting there, you're on your own, your wife hates you, you've got a divorce, or your husband hates you, you've got a divorce, and you're sitting there and you're replaying, because the mind keeps replaying. I'm old, so to call it the video, the tape, or whatever. The cassette is playing. The cassette. Well, I'm wearing a... People may not be able to see.
I see your T-shirt, the cassette.
But I'm wearing a T-shirt with tape cassettes, which I don't want to... If you don't know what it is, then Google it. And it's a technical drawing of how they're made. So, you know, whatever. I just like it. But the thing goes... So the thing goes round and round in your brain. And so say, for instance, you pick an argument. And I remember one day I was having an argument with my ex, and then she said this. But in the moment, I didn't get what she said. In the moment, I was like, I'm fighting, so I want to win, you know. But then now I'm recalling the conversation, you can dissect it. You can go, that's what she meant. In hindsight, she didn't mean that. If I'd listened and not tried to win, I would have heard this. And then a lot of times, in my reflections, and I went through this I was single for 15 years after my divorce, and for the first 10 years, I was in deep healing because I couldn't get out of this, what I call divorce paralysis. And then it was dissecting things, going like, "Wow, bam, going on there, I see it." The beginning, it was totally and utterly her fault. After a while, I realized, and this is what I do a marriage workshop called this, I realized that I wasn't paying attention. I realized that we were having in this engagement and I want to win, or, you know, not thinking is another piece of wisdom I learned, that when you win, someone else loses. And so, and actually that person is actually you, because I'm a pastor, as you know, and I come from this idea that when you come married, you're one. So right. Though I'm thinking I'm having this competition and I'm beating my wife or I'm getting the upper hand, I don't realize that if she's losing, I lose. She's losing, I'm losing. I'm not. So I'm actually sabotaging not only her and our marriage, but I'm actually sabotaging myself. At the moment I'm doing it, I'm not thinking those wonderful egalitarian, wise thoughts. At the moment I'm like, look, you're wrong.
That's an interesting perspective, the biblical worldview, that when you become married, you become one. So whenever there is an argument or whenever there is any losses to be had or made, I am losing. If I shifted, or if we shifted our mindset in relationships to think that way, then hurt can take on a different meaning, because it's not only one person who's hurting. Everyone is hurting.
Yes.
And the healing takes on a different meaning too. I can't be alone in the healing because we both hurt.
Yes, there's healing, or there is, well, for instance, this is what I do know, okay? I know that as much, and this is the hard part of it, because when someone does infidelity betrayal against you, you're the victim.
But what
you have to understand, and you haven't got time to process this, or you don't care about anybody, you can only deal about your pain, is the other person needs healing too.
Right, that's
true,
yeah.
The person that's able to do this was hurt somewhere else. Because I didn't really.
Hurt people.
They were hurt somewhere else. They were hurt in their childhood. They were hurt somewhere else. And they come along. I mean, when I met my ex told me that if I ever, because one of her boyfriends cheated, she told me that if I ever cheated, that she would leave me immediately. And yet, 10 whatever years later, she was the person who did this. You know, so right now we can have this conversation, and it's like, you know, I can rationalize some of it, but in the pain, you can't see it. Pain is blindingly black.
So the first step in the journey of healing is to confront the pain, the hurt, wherever it's coming from. Maybe it's a broken heart, cheated on, somebody dumped you for no reason, or it's divorce.
Yeah.
You have to sit with that pain and confront it.
You have to. So let me help your audience here, because I don't want to make it like, I feel pain, let's confront it. Because that is so unhuman.
I was about to ask you, where do I even begin with that? Like, what does
this
it
is,
even look
this is,
like?
This is what really happens, and this is the image that springs into mind. It's not planned. I'm just thinking, because as you were saying what you were saying, I had a problem with the as the pain comes along. Let's work on the pain. It's like this is what it's really like. It's like the pain hits you, and the pain is multiple. The pain is every day. The pain is whatever. And it's like, let's call it in my journey, it was 2 years. So it took me 2.5 years to 3 years before I confronted my pain. So I'm not saying there's like a switch. It happened. There we go. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is like almost you are in pain, and you're like, and then you're just doing that nonstop. You're trying to get the pain down. And then you almost scream yourself out. You know when you have your child and the child screams itself, so it's just tired. Okay? Mm-hmm. That can be 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. You scream yourself out, and also the other thing you're doing is that you're doing everything to get rid of the pain. So you're going, please, baby, please, baby, please, baby, please, baby, please, text. No, I shouldn't text her. I shouldn't text him. I need to give them time to just be them, give them some space. Do you know what? I need to text them. Or you see a text, or you see a quote, or you see something, and this is such a good point. I have to send them this point. And then you become almost a stalker. And this one thing is going to make the difference or whatever. And then every time you send it, you, especially if they ignore you. My ex was clever. She ignored me. She just ignored me, which created even more pain. Nothing worse.
It was more intense.
She didn't even go, "You're talking a pile of rubbish, get lost." Or she didn't respond at all. So in the end, you're fighting with yourself. You're like, you know, I'm punching.
Punching the ear.
You know, and it's nothing. So I'm saying there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of emotion there. There's a lot of stuff. And ultimately, you have to punch it out if you go in the gym, or you have to emotionally just hit bottom. Mm-hmm. You just hit bottom. And you know, I'm thinking I'm a pastor for a church, and there's a saying in the Bible that just goes, "Be still." And there comes a time with all the pain that there's stillness. There's like, because especially if you're a man and you want to fix things all the time and you want to fix it, and you can't fix it because there's nothing to fix. It's like you're there and you're still and you're helpless and you're nothing and you've hit the bottom. So now you're at the bottom.
Your resources have run out.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is this understanding that when you're in pain, you have to find something or do something that would allow you to heal.
Yes.
For some, it gets into toxic habits, substance abuse, alcohol. For some, it's perhaps moving on to the next person when you haven't completely healed.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be a better way.
Yes.
Some people say, you know what, I just listen to music. And where do you even begin with this? I know you're screaming. You want to drown the noise of the pain with whatever you were doing.
Mm.
Somebody's sitting. The relationship has failed. I'm talking to the millennials. The relationship has failed.
Yes.
And commitment has different meanings. And for millennials, commitment is another problem of us in itself.
Yeah.
So the relationship just ended, Paul.
Mm.
Or I'm realizing that, you know what, this relationship wasn't worth it. How do I pick up the pieces? Let's use the title of your book. How do I pick up the pieces?
Let me tell you what we all normally do. We fake it.
Ah.
I don't know. I'm not a millennial. I'm slightly older, so they might not listen to me. But we fake it because all of this conversation, its context is that we have to live life.
Right.
Context is that you work for a living. I was an advertising sales director. So for 2 years as an advertising sales director, I didn't tell anybody. I was in this position of exalted position, which wasn't allowed to have weaknesses. I didn't tell anybody.
Weakness.
I faked my existence. I had to be strong. I was only weak when I got in my car in a private space. In between, you have to get on with life, and also. And also with our social media, and I'm into social media big time, but I don't know how much the millennials are, is that sometimes you're expressing yourself more to social media than you are to people.
Hmm.
And so you're able, I work in London. The number one disease of London before the pandemic was loneliness. The number one disease after the pandemic or now is even more loneliness. That our sense of connection. It's almost like if you and I was to meet, we would grab a coffee and the first thing we would do was to get our phones out and speak to the person, connect with the person that's not in front of us. We'd be arranging a meeting with the other people that are not there. Then we would meet those other people. And then once we're with them, we get our phones again and then
find somebody else.
We relate to our phones. We relate to the other rather than be able to relate to the person in front of them. I believe that our social skills with the pandemic is doing that. I think our vocabulary, our writing, I'm terrible now. To write a complete sentence without you, you know, not a full you, but just with the letter you, is very difficult for me. And I think that I think one of the most difficult things we have as people is connecting, is staying connected and staying connected. And the hardest thing, one of my advice is us healing, but healing in community.
There's healing in community. So does if I'm on my own and I'm trying to numb the pain, is that part of the paralysis you were talking about?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Very much. It was the loneliness. It was the loneliness that killed you. And the reason you have the loneliness is because you are shocked, you're angry, you're confused, you're numb, you're empty, you're humiliated. It's one of the things, humiliated. We all want to, you know, we all want to be significant. We want to be worthy. We want to be acceptance. We want to be loved. I mean, I used to joke that I've got a certificate to say that I'm a failure. It's called a divorce paper. Mm. I've got a certificate that says, please stay away from me. I'm not worthy of loving. Who wants that when our whole life is us impressing other people to want them to like us?
We all want to belong.
And then, let me tell you a funny thing. So I was telling someone the other day, so the funny thing is that as I was going through the divorce, I mean, my ex's family are amazing, wonderful, wonderful people. And her father died from prostate cancer. And he was a beautiful man. We got on very, very well. And I remember I used to go and see him at 10 o'clock in the hospice. And he used to say to me, isn't it funny, Paul, how everybody in this family loves you other than your wife? And he used to laugh about it. Ah, isn't it funny, Paul, that everybody, you know, and it was really, you know, the power of the community, it was strong, but at the same time, you know, it was because families marry, you know, we connect villages, we connect this. And in the same way we connect them is the same way I think that I discovered that that healing in community is very powerful. I think that if we were in a community and if we had community ethics, which are very old Eastern ethics, you know, we live in the West, but if we look at Eastern ethics, Eastern ethics is far more communal. It's about it's about we. Western ethics is about us. It's about my dream. It's about hedonism. It's about my pleasure. Eastern ethics is how does my pleasure, how does the way I behave affect the community, affect the village? And so the village supports me because I support the village and my generosity is to it. Now I'm just...
So the identity is not in the individual. The identity is in community. So if you want to find your identity, if you were to find yourself, as it were, that healing, you can't lock yourself away. You have to be in community. It means that you have to talk about your story too.
Yeah, I love the way you're phrasing the questions because you're creating another question. Because I don't think it's. I think for us, it's not either or. I think it's the abdication or the absence completely of the community that's been our problem. So for instance, let me give you an example. So I used to run a church in Notting Hill near Grenfell. Mm-hmm. So we used to have a lot of Australians there, and Australians were given passport visas to come over to England, spend 2 years, and after 2 years they have a cultural travel, and then they go back to Australia and go from there. But some of them loved England. I know it's unbelievable, but they loved England, they loved it, and they stayed longer. And they were wonderful, and they're really incredible people, and they were in my leadership teams. And then one day they would turn up and say, I'm pregnant. And I'd go, oh, no. okay, in my brain. I wouldn't say it out loud. I'd say, congratulations, wonderful, it's amazing. But in my brain, I'd go, oh no, because I knew what it meant. This is what it meant. It meant these two incredible people that were incredible leaders in my church were about to leave. Why were they about to leave? Because they lived a really wonderful couple hedonistic Western life. But now they realized that they were going to have a baby and they needed their community. They're very communal people. And so they went back. They'd always say, look, I really don't want to leave. I really don't want to leave. But it's better because I've got my aunts, my uncles, my this, my that, all around them, support structure all around them. They would come over to England and you'd see the support structure and you'd be nodding going like, you got to go back.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go back. It was my best example of the power. I saw the power of the community at work in this stance.
So the healing is not a linear thing.
No.
It's multifaceted.
Yes.
And the healing is in the experience. And each person's experience is different. No two people like share the same experience. No. I can take from your step 3 or your step 4 of healing, and that could be my step 1.
Yeah.
And in the process of me doing that, I shouldn't shun away community.
I'm saying as a Westernized person that my healing began in community. My healing began, number one, when I expressed my pain. In confronting, I was able to express my pain. And number two, in community. Number one, two, in community. I read this thing the other day. So it's a common, you know, you can Google these things now. You know, we're not that clever. There was a professor did Harvard professor did an interview with, was it followed 7,000 people over 9, I'm trying to film, 7,000 people over 9 years. And, okay. and then found out that if you took a dose of drugs, and you had alcohol abuse and you had this and you had that, all the bad things that we would say, you smoked or whatever, but you were in a strong social group, that you lived longer than someone that was eating tofu but that was alone. And the final sort of quote of this research said, it is better to eat chocolate. Well, they had, in England we say chocolate, but in America you said Twinkies. But the American quote was, it's better to eat Twinkies with friends than to eat broccoli alone. Because of the power of the community.
It's interesting because we're such an individualistic society. And the only time that you get to see me, supposedly see me, is on social media. And that's not even who I am.
No, it's a profile. It's an edited profile.
Yeah, it's not even
profile.
Who I am.
And also, it's someone said to me the other day, just to cut what you're saying, maybe it will help. Someone said, have you noticed what the biggest section in the bookshops is? Like, no, what is it? Self-help. Or community.
And that's
help.
The buzzword now.
Not group help, self-help.
And that's the buzzword now, self-help, self-help, self-help.
My contention is this with self-help, that the information helps, but the implementation works better in a community. And when I mean community, I mean simply, say it was me and you, I mean me and my brother. In my brother's birthday tomorrow. Actually, for you, it's the 4th of June. So the 4th of June is my brother's birthday. So my brother took me to the gym. My brother's 3.5 years younger than me. Actually, 3 3/4 younger than me. You know this thing when your brothers and sisters, you know that.
You got to get it right, the quarter there.
Yeah, it's like when you have babies and you're like, how old are you? Oh, it's 10 weeks and 5 days. You know, like, you know, when you're 31, it's like, you know, it's not, you know, 31 and a half. So anyway, my brother took me to the gym one day. And me and my brother are very competitive. We play sport, you know, we're battling. So he said to me, listen, I'm going to go to the gym, but before I say anything to you, I want you to know that you can't beat me. You know, But as he's saying that, I'm thinking to myself, do you know what? I can win. I'm not happy with this. But he says, listen, please do me a favor. I know what you're like. You can't win. I've been doing this for years. You can't be as heavy as me. So because I would go in and he would lift whatever and I would try and lift it. Now I'd lift it, but I won't be able to walk for the next 2 years. So so he said, just follow me. If you follow me, do the instructions, this will be the best weight session ever for you, ever. Okay? I went, okay. So I suspended my competitive brain and it was brilliant. It was brilliant. Because I would do this weights, which was far less than his, but it was in within my capacity. Mm-hmm. And I'd get to eight and I couldn't do any more. And he'd go, you can do it. Go on, you can do it. And then I'd do nine. Come on, Paul, you can do it. One more, come on. I would do 10. And then we do this to 12. And I know that I couldn't do the last four without him. But I did it. But I did it. Imagine, this is the community I'm talking about. It doesn't mean one, it can be a community of one. Imagine if you had someone in your life, in every aspect of your life, that you would, every time you would be lesser than, that they would simply be able to say with you, you can do it. Just one more. You can do it. I'm here for you. You can do it. I'm here to inspire you. I'm here to make you bigger. I'm never going to leave you. I'm never going to forsake you. I'm going to be here for you. Whatever the time of the day, whatever the time of the morning, whatever pain you're going through, no matter how broken you are, I think you are worth more than this. And I want you to believe it too. Because the problem is that we don't believe it.
You know what I'm hearing you say, Paul? And sometimes we can be proactive in some of these things. It means that in my journey, in my life, mm-hmm. I need to have somebody who's going to be in my corner in my health. I need to have somebody in my life who's going to be in my corner when it comes to spiritual matters. I need somebody who's going to be in my corner when it comes to my marital issues.
Yep.
My community is expanding, which means the capacity for me to heal becomes bigger, because there's somebody who's cheering for me in whatever area. If I fall in one area, there's somebody there who's going to be able to cheer me on. So things, we can get up, we can do this.
Absolutely.
You can heal. I know you can work this. I know you can make it.
Absolutely. So what I, you've used words, which are buzzwords to me. I'm writing down, scribbling because of you just triggered me. So, because one of the things I say to people, one of the first things I say to my clients in terms of confronting their pain is create their own fan club. Just create their own fan club. Find one, two. Men, it's more difficult because they don't like being honest with people. You know, so you and I would...
No, we're fine. We got it made. We don't need nobody.
Yeah, absolutely. So you and I would be buddies, and you tell me after a while we'd be to our core, and then number three would come in and we'd go back to ego and we'd be like, yeah, I've got a big Ferrari. I've got a bigger Ferrari, whatever, before we get vulnerable again. Whereas in gender, I found that with women, they're more have a conversation more. So we struggle. But I say to everybody, form a cheerleading, a fan club. Form a cheerleading, someone that's just going to cheer for you. Sometimes it isn't family members. Someone that will cheer for you even when you're not worth cheering for, or someone who's going to go, do you know what? Go for it. I'm thinking about leaving my job and doing this, but I don't know whether I can. Yes, you can. Go for it. Go for it. You can do it. And even if you fall flat on your face, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. There's a book. I'm trying to remember the name of the book. Anyway, I'll get the book later. So anyway, it talks about what makes the pivotal parts of your growth, okay? So, and I'll start with the women because the male is where I'm going to get to the point. So it's called Wild at Heart. And so it's Wild at Heart and Captivated. This is the book, okay? The Wild at Heart is for men, Captivated is for women. And so on the female version, This is supposedly the most critical part of our existence, is that for a lady, she's eight. She's a little girl. She's seven or eight. The family are going to visit the relatives on a Sunday or Sunday afternoon. And mm-hmm. she comes down the stairs in her dress. And as she comes down the stairs in her dress, she sees her father at the bottom of the stairs. And she says, "Daddy, does this dress look good on me? Do I look beautiful?" That's what she's asking. Mm-hmm. And the next reaction is supposedly the reaction that seems to scar is the stamp on her ego. If there's anything other than, "Wow, you look beautiful." Mm-hmm. If he says, "Well, where are your shoes?" Wrong answer. Wrong answer. The only answer is for the ego, for the self-worth is "You look beautiful, baby. You look amazing. You look wonderful." Because in asking about the shoes, you're actually saying that she needs something else to look beautiful. Now, you're not saying that. You're being practical. But that's right. That's what happens. And then this wrong answer then becomes this thing that she's always achieving for love. And years later, we can discuss promiscuity or whatever it is, however these things manifest itself. And then we're all, as my friend said to me the other day, "Do you know what, Paul? I think we all end up on someone's counseling couch at the end of the day, no matter how you were brought up." And when they're there, they'll recall the moment when the person they love most seemed to not love them as much, to go from there. But for a male one, it's a different one. So he's 8, he's on a swing. And as he's on the swing and his father's swinging, he's swing on the swing, he's about to jump off, and he turns around to his father and he says, "Dad, watch this." Now, if the father says, "Slow down, don't do it," this hurts his self-esteem. What galvanizes self-esteem is when the father goes, "Go on, son, you can do it." And even if he does it and breaks his leg, doesn't matter. He now there's someone who believes in him. There's someone who believes he can do it. So the reason I'm saying this is that in the fan group, the cheerleader is so important. It's so important. It's the fact that that you have this messages in your brain. The messages in your brain is that you can do it. There's an old movie. I say old. There's an old movie by Spike Lee, and in the movie there's a guy that's carrying a ghetto blaster. You can tell I'm old. You know, I think he's playing tape cassettes.
We're talking about cassettes and ghetto blaster.
Yeah. So anyway, he's playing this big, I don't know what you'd call it. We don't have it in our day anymore. But there's this big musical implement on the side of his shoulder. Call it a big speaker on the side of his shoulder. And on this speaker, he's walking around with this music. You know, for now, the music doesn't matter, but it's like, you know, the music is blaring out. And then when he comes up to you, and he comes up to someone he likes, he turns the music down and he has a conversation. And so he has a conversation with him. And then as he's going away, he turns the music box up. And then there's this massive music going into his right ear. Now, as you're looking at this, as any normal human being, you're thinking, "That's ridiculous. That's really going to go nuts." But that is one of my favorite images. And it's just, let me tell you why it's a favorite image. So the reason for favorite image, and I talk about a lot about this, is that the biggest problem in pain of our lives is how we talk to ourselves. The biggest problem is not what people say to us, it's the fact that we repeat it to ourselves. And that someone says something, they say 300 amazing things. I remember I spoke, I said it, it was amazing. And as I came out, there were 300 people there, and one woman said to me, "Thank you very much for that very, very short sermon. I can't tell you what I spoke about. I can't tell you anything. All I can tell you is many years later.
It was a short sermon."
But I just remembered this woman saying it was a short, and I was insulted by this, you know. And other 299 other people said, "I really enjoyed this," whatever. But I remembered the negative of this. Even to this day, the reason I can tell you this is because I can remember this woman. How dare she say this thing? So we have a propensity psychologically to just hold on to this negative. And then after doing it, we repeat it to ourselves. And the code says, the repetition says, "You're not good enough. You're not worthy." Who the hell do you think you are? What do you think? Why do you matter? Why do you do this? So I decided to go to the self-help department of the library, of the bookshops, and go and buy the books. I know we're on podcasts, but behind me is a lot of books, and a lot of them are incredible self-help books. And even though I got all these self-help books, I still heard the voices. I still kept repeating. And so I decided, I said, how do I get rid of these voices? And I decided the way you get rid of the voices is actually to read and implement the self-help books by turning up the ghetto blaster louder. That no longer was I focused on the voice that kept repeating itself. I decided to amplify the other voice that says, don't listen to that voice. Listen to this voice. Listen to that you're chosen. Listen to that you're special. Listen to your significance. Look at the focus on the thing, the positive things that you've done. That person said you were great. Oh, yeah, I didn't remember that. Oh, wow, yeah. I am good at something rather than I'm useless. And amplify that voice. So rather than spend all the time trying to negate this voice, which I think as our is our nature, perpetual human nature, is to do this to ourselves. But now I'm in for the amplification.
Amplify. So, Paul, you keep talking about, you mentioned, brother, this idea of community, and you emphasize the need to have a community, cheerleaders, as you tagged it. What is it about this that you emphasize this need for community? What's up with that?
My obsession with community was one day I was watching a Bruce Springsteen video, which some people might not know is your audience, but Bruce Springsteen's an old rock star, probably famous for Born in the USA. And I was flicking through YouTube and I came across this song. And when I came across this song, I was transfixed by this song. And it's Bruce Springsteen starting this song. And he sings one verse, and then all the other members of his band sing a verse. And then there's a closing shot where they, after all the band come together, and it starts with his face, and it's a wide shot that all the band are together. And they keep singing this song. This song goes on for 6 or 7 minutes. And this is what the song says. I'll wait for you. And if I fall behind, wait for me. All six members of the band sing this song. A verse in this song. And the last line in each verse is, I'll wait for you. And if I fall behind, wait for me. And as I watched this, and I was reflecting on my book, and I was reflecting on my pain, and I was reflecting on healing, I wanted to be in this band. Because I knew that in this community, there would be healing, there would be safety, there would be a safe place. And it was there I came to this realization that self-help helps. But the real help comes in the community, and that helps in generosity. So then, funny story we talk about social media. So due to lots of things, I don't sleep very well. And when you're in pain, you know, you have insomnia, you have these nights, these sleepless nights. And I started being, people knew that I was divorced. And so people on the internet from all over the world started, you know, seeing my posts or whatever. And then they'd say, can I talk to you? And so 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd be talking to people about different things, their pain and their hurts. And then I remember one day in culmination over a year period, 4 women came to me to tell me that they were raped. Such was the depth of intimacy that was going on in these conversations. Men who secretly were having affairs or in high positions were coming and sharing their story with me. And I almost became maybe I should call myself that, the internet counselor. And there I was. And here I was in my pain. But as I was doing this, my pain didn't seem to hurt anymore. My pain, it was incredible. I was excited. I was enthused. I was empowered to help other people. We see this in organizations such as the AA and Narcotics Anonymous, mm-hmm. where you have a mentor and you who looks after you. But then because mm-hmm. you know you are looked after, you have the power to be a mentee. And this is why I'm talking about the community. This is why I'm seeing that. And what I saw was in that cycle that I was getting healed. It was in this cycle of generosity. It was in this cycle of just giving. I was just decided, you know what? I'm not going to give to myself anymore. I'm not going to self-help on its own. It's not going to work for me. I'm just going to give. There's a book that says give. We used to sing a song, give and it will come back to you. I just decided to give. And the universe gave it back.
It's interesting because more often we tend to say, don't focus on your pain, but what do you focus on? Yes. And this gives an answer to this idea. Don't focus on your pain. Focus on giving.
Yes.
Because that will truly drown your pain and, in fact, heal.
Generosity healed. The generosity cycle generosity healed heals. Me. The generosity cycle healed me. I spent years reading the books, and it wasn't until generosity, and I don't know where it came from. Maybe it was just tiredness, exasperated at the same thing. But it wasn't until I started to give. And then I saw that actually people would come to me and say, thank you so much, I'm healed, or the situation has got better. And even though my situation was getting no better, I could see that the effects of other people's situation was getting better, which meant that I thought that...
Others transformed.
Yeah, so I thought that this transformation, that meant, wow, so this transformation is on its way to me. And so I was more patient because I knew it existed. I thought, okay, like a roller coaster, it's coming, mine's going to come, it's okay. And then it was a beautiful cycle to recognize and for it to be to reveal to me. It wasn't something that I sought, I don't know, it was something, I'm glad that my eyes were open to see the beauty of it.
Paul, I know we can go on and on with this conversation, the journey of healing. It is a journey. You go 1, 2, 3, 4 steps, you crash, you get up, and sometimes you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you got to walk back again and start again. But the good thing is that as long as you keep going, as long as you confront the pain, as long as you stay in community or find community and you amplify the good voices. Paul, where can we find more information about you? What are you up to?
I'm very much in the, I'm old, so I'm on Facebook a lot. My name is Paul King Brown on Facebook, and I run a divorce and infidelity support group. That's where I basically, I'm on LinkedIn, Paul King Brown. If you want to email me, it's pickingupthepiecesltd@gmail.com.
You have a book.
Yeah, I have a book called Picking Up the Pieces. Paul King Brown, it's on Amazon. It's getting great reviews. If you actually, as part of this program, I was going to say that if you send me an email to pickingupthepiecesltd@gmail.com, I will send you a free Kindle copy of the book. So do this. This is what I would do. Go to Amazon, check me out. If you see the reviews, if you think they're for real, email me at pickingupthepiecesltd@gmail.com. I will send you a free book.
All right, there it is, folks. Thank you so much, Paul. This is another episode of Relationship Factor. As always, if you like the episode, go ahead and follow, share, tell everybody that's listened to a podcast and who wants to move from problem to solution, from functional to exceptional relationship. You can find more information at relationshipfactor.org. You can get resources, check out other episodes. As always, it's another episode of fun and growth. Relationship Factor, we out. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.